The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Named America's Most Compelling Popular Historian, Eric Larson is the best-selling author of 8 critically acclaimed books, including The Splendid and the Vile, A Chronicle of Churchill and London During the Blitz, In the Garden of Beasts, The Story of the First American Ambassador to Nazi Germany, and Devil in the White City, a history of the serial killer who stalked attendees of the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago and later lived just a few blocks behind this building. In his new bestseller, The Demon of Unrest, Larson delves into the 5 pivotal months preceding the Civil War to explore the controversies, crises, and personalities that led our young country into its bloodiest conflict to date. This evening, Eric Larson will be in conversation with award-winning journalist and broadcaster Tracy Matysak. We're always happy to have them both back. Please welcome our guests.
Well, good evening, everyone. It is delightful to see so many of you here on a Sunday evening. Thank you so much for making time to be with us. And how about another warm welcome for Eric Larson?
Thank you.
Well, we are delighted to have you here at the Free Library of Philadelphia with yet another of your books. Thank you for writing this book, The Demon of Unrest, a saga of hubris, heartbreak, and heroism at the dawn of the Civil War. It is a wonderful book, and we'll have lots to talk about. If you've been here before, then you know that Eric and I will have a conversation, and then we'll open it up for your questions. So if you have a question for him, just raise your hand. We've got some staff members with microphones, and we'll get a microphone to you and get through as many questions as we can in the time we have.
And so, footnote, I lived in Philadelphia for about 3 years. I am a Philadelphian. I lived in Bucks County. I worked for the Bucks County Courier Times for several years. Went to Penn, so I have all kinds of connections. And further footnote, when I was working, I worked for the Wall Street Journal here when there was a Wall Street Journal Bureau in Philadelphia. There is none now. And I had the honor to be the first person at the Wall Street Journal to write a profile of a dead man, because I had set out to profile a loan shark named Frank Sindone. Does that name ring a bell to anybody? You were in debt to him? So I assigned myself to do a profile of Frank Sindone. It was going well. Met the head of the Philly Police Organized Crime Intelligence Unit over lunch at Bookbinders. And he says, you should probably know that there is a contract out on Frank. I'm like, oh, okay. And then sure enough, 2 weeks later, I get a call from this intelligence guy from the cops. And he says, well, we found Frank this morning in 2 trash bags.
Oh.
But I did the story anyway. So anyway, sorry for that divergent
thing. The news must go on, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, we'll have to get you an Eagles jersey or something now that we know that you're
absolutely
an honorary Philadelphian.
Semper Fi, yep.
Yes, indeed. Well, so the book is centered on South Carolina, primarily, which, as relatively small as it is, played an outsized role in the run-up to the Civil War. And, Eric, I'm wondering if you can kind of characterize for us the mood in South Carolina at that time and sort of the way that the state thought about itself toward the end of 1860 as that secessionist fervor was beginning to grow.
Sure, yeah. So South Carolina then in the antebellum period, even other southern states were embarrassed by South Carolina. South Carolina was renowned as being a cranky state, rebellious, touchy, you know, their planters were prone to duels, you know. It was just a really sort of a hotbed of unhappiness. And that was really what the state of the state was. I mean, it was a state in decline, also financial decline, economic decline. Fields were being over-farmed. Its political power was being reduced. It was losing population. And yet here's this little state that has suddenly become the fulcrum of what became America's greatest tragedy.
Yeah. What's the significance of the title, The Demon of Unrest?
So the Demon of... I love that title. The Demon of Unrest. The Demon of Unrest. There is a gentleman in the book who writes a letter, and in the course of that letter, he talks about the demon of unrest loose in the land. And as soon as I saw that, I knew that was going to be my title, because that's really, really kind of captures it, the demon of unrest. So that's where that came from.
You know, in thinking about South Carolina and the state it was in at the time, it also had a disproportionate number of enslaved people relative to the general population. I think it was something like more than half.
Yes. Far more enslaved blacks than the white population.
And so there were two big fears primarily that people
One other footnote, if I may. Pardon me, I will be offering footnotes throughout this venture. Columbia, this gives you an index of how bizarre the whole saga is, that this little state caused this big problem. Columbia, the capital of South Carolina in this period, had 6,060 people, population of 6,060, half of whom were white, half of whom were enslaved blacks and freed blacks, most of them enslaved blacks. So this was not a metropolis. This was not, you know, this was like, the town I grew up in, Long Island, had 50,000 people, and that was too small for me. So,
yeah. So there were two great fears primarily that people in the South had at the time, white people in the South, that black people would at some point potentially be on equal footing with them, and also that there would be a slave insurrection at some point. And I'd like you to address kind of how those fears really fueled that secessionist fervor.
Yeah, it's interesting. First of all, the fear that blacks would achieve equality of whites was so incredible to me. I mean, there's one guy who actually writes, he says, you know, if we let this thing go this far, there may even be a black president. kind of like that, yeah. You know. But one of the big fears, though, was of insurrection, that blacks would, the black slaves, the enslaved blacks would rise up and kill their masters in their sleep. Planters, even though they denied it, were terrified of being poisoned in the night by their house slaves. And these fears were very important because in the antebellum period, a very important shift had occurred, and that is that, you know, around 1800, even the planters felt that slavery was a necessary evil. But then as time passed, they sort of said, no, why are we kowtowing to the northern sympathies, northern attitudes about slavery? And they began to persuade themselves through the pro-slavery movement and so forth that slavery was actually a good thing, a positive good thing, that it was good for the slaves because all their needs were met. They were insulated from economic change. They were not subject to the kind of wage slavery that northern people were subject to. So you had this trend moving along where in the South they were convincing themselves that slavery was good, and this played into the whole Southern honor thing. Planters were totally besotted with the idea of honor, that they were honorable men. They called themselves the chivalry. And so the chivalry could not accept that slavery was evil. Slavery was good. But meanwhile, in the North, 1808, the United States bans the international slave trade. It allows the domestic, but the international slave trade is on paper at least, banned. Britain bans slavery as well, and the world begins to move radically away from slavery, to finding slavery, condemning slavery as an unalloyed sin. You know, abolitionists come to the fore. Garrison's newspaper, The Liberator, is founded in, I think, 1830-something. And the North becomes more and more opposed to slavery, attacking slavery. And in the South, where they become more and more convinced that they are good guys for having slaves, this is like besmirching their honor. And they took that really to heart. Yeah. They really felt that this was this was a slight against them as human beings. Yeah. And that was the fuel that, that is the background fuel that started, led to this.
And isn't it interesting, you know, you mention how they, people in the South were convincing themselves that in fact slavery was a good thing, not just for them, but for the enslaved people.
Right.
And how 160 years later, there are people who are saying, well, slavery actually may have been beneficial to black people.
Yeah.
I mean,
the funny thing is that in terms of the pro-slavery argument, they came at it from all different directions. There were a number of racist, we would call them today anthropologists, who argued that there were all kinds of anthropological reasons for why enslaved blacks were ideal for this kind of work. There were those who argued that the Bible justified slavery. And then, of course, it's just the ideas that I mentioned before, which is that slaves, you know, were actually better off under you know, the mastery of their white overlords. Never mind that, like, one villain in my book, James Henry Hammond, has a manual for his overseer, and he has a very specific section that governs exactly how to whip your enslaved people. So. Yeah.
He was a fascinating character, too, and maybe we'll get to him. But speaking of characters, there are several that you really kind of put the spotlight on, and certainly one of them is Major Anderson,
yes,
right, who was committed to the Union but was sympathetic to the South. He was a former slaveholder. He also was the head of the garrison there at Fort Sumter.
He was in charge of all of the federal presence in Charleston,
yeah,
Harbor.
I'd like you to talk about him and the fact that he was not alone in being loyal to the Union, but sympathetic to the South. There was a lot of that.
There was a lot of that. So Major Robert Anderson, he was a former slave owner. They had slaves, he and his wife, and they divested themselves of their enslaved population. He was from Kentucky. His wife was from Georgia. Her father was a prominent Revolutionary War general. They still owned slaves. So that, yeah, they were sympathetic to the South, but there was a very important thing to know about Major Anderson. And yes, he was loyal, but it wasn't so much to the Union, it was to the United States Army. There's a distinction there. He had made an oath to the United States Army, and by God, he was going to be loyal to that oath. And it's interesting because when he was appointed, the war secretary was very much a Southern favoring guy. In fact, he soon defected to the South. He's the guy who chose Anderson for this position to replace somebody else in November of 1860. There's a lot of speculation about, you know, clearly he chose Anderson because it's likely that he would have been able to mollify South Carolinians if anybody could. But also there's speculation that the war secretary actually expected him to turn over the forts and walk away. But that was not Major Anderson.
Yeah. Edmund Ruffin is another of the characters that you spotlight, and he was indeed a character and an ardent secessionist, obsessed with the idea.
Edmund Ruffin, I love him. He's just such a vile human being. I mean, it's rare when you're writing a book that you can just, you don't even have to be nice. You know that this guy is awful. So Edmund Ruffin was a planter in Virginia, actually, and he was an ardent advocate of secession. And he was really annoyed that Virginia was not getting on the case. Virginia was not joining the program. And so he looked to South Carolina, and these guys have it right. They have it right. So he goes down to South Carolina to try to do all he can to help. But Ruffin is one reason Ruffin is in the book, and one reason Senator James Henry Hammond is in the book, you mentioned him before. One problem with writing about the Civil War, and by the way, I am on record as having said numerous times that I would never write a book about the Civil War. You can Google that. And here I am writing a book about the Civil War. We can talk about the origins of that
sure,
if you will. Now, why did I get off on that?
Well, we were talking about Edmund Ruffin.
Ruffin, yeah, and the villains. So the reason they're important is to talk about Fort Sumter, to talk about the start of the Civil War and Lincoln's election, there's a lot of backstory, you know, a lot of backstory. And you can tell that backstory, you know, a couple of ways. If you tell it, purely in an expository way, your readers will be hanging themselves after the second chapter. Because it's just, there's a lot, and it can be very, very dull. But these guys, they lived these moments, and certain moments in the run-up to the election and to the Civil War were very important to them. And Ruffin is a case in point. Ruffin, it's a very tragic character, actually. I mean, you sort of have to picture this guy. He's a man of middling height. He's got white hair down to his shoulders. He's got this sort of coarse, sharp cheekbones. He looks like a fundamentalist preacher, if you could sort of imagine what one would look like. Only the religion that he preached was secession. Tragic, tragic life. I mean, one summer alone, he loses three daughters to fevers. Then he loses a fourth daughter, metaphorically, who goes off, gets married, and goes off to some far-flung locale that, you know, as I say in the book, you know, is as good as death because you can't get there. You know, it's too far away. And things were going so badly for Ruffin that at one point he starts thinking about suicide. He's just, you know, nothing's happening. Nobody respects me. And for him, it was all about self-affirmation as well. Doesn't that sound familiar? It was all about self-affirmation, and nobody was giving him any credit for his ardent, you know, pro-secession, whatever. And so he's on the verge, actually, of committing suicide. Or so his diary indicates. He wrote, by the way, a 4,000-page diary. He's on the verge of committing suicide when suddenly there is good news. There's good news. John Brown seizes the arsenal at Harper's Ferry, and suddenly Edmund Ruffin has a new lease on life. Literally, he is suddenly supercharged. He just feels like his life is back. He goes so far as to attend the execution of Brown, which was only, you were only allowed to attend it if you were a military person, if you had military credentials. He had none. He signs up with a South Carolina cadet, sort of a military school. He's allowed to be a cadet for one day, and they give him a uniform and a musket, and he's allowed to march with these little 19-year-olds, you know, this guy is like 60, he's allowed to march with them and watch this execution of John Brown. It made his day. Now, the thing about Ruffin is that he was a hateful man. He hated the North. He hated Yankees. It's just completely unalloyed hatred. He also, I will give him some credit, he is one of the few people in the antebellum era who was able to anticipate the kind of macabre conflict that a civil war could possibly yield. He writes a book called Anticipations of the Future. 416 pages. He whips it out in like 4 months. He recognizes that it's a piece of crap. He even says so. not in those terms, but boy, let me tell you, don't try to read this book. But what he does forecast is this attack on New York City by Southern forces that leaves every building in New York City burned to the ground, corpses on the street, and the people who had accompanied John Brown into Virginia are all the survivors are hung from the same tree, left for vultures to devour. That's his vision of you know, what's coming. And he's more or less right, except for the New York burning. Anyway, sorry. When you come across a character like Ruffin as a writer, you know, it's like, thank you, God.
Lot to work with there, yeah. Of course, President Abraham Lincoln, who also could hardly be described as an abolitionist at the time, was content to let slavery be where it was. And as you write in the book, did not seem to fully grasp the determination of the South to secede, did not seem to really understand how determined they were.
I think it's fair to say that he did not, at this point, understand the South. He did not understand the passions of the South. What he proposed, and he had to do this in certain ways through friends and newspapers and so forth and through some speeches, and we can get to how he eventually treated being president before the inauguration. But he made a point of saying that, look, I, as you pointed out, I am not going to disturb slavery as it exists currently in the states in the South. you know, you're free to continue to own your enslaved populations. I am not going to get in your way. He also went so far as to endorse the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which was a federal law that allowed planters in the South to travel north with impunity to retrieve escaped slaves and bring them back to the South. This was a law that in the North was reviled. And in fact, it led to a number of states passing personal liberty laws to directly counteract the effect of the Fugitive Slave Act. So for Lincoln to say that he would actually endorse and support the Fugitive Slave Act, this was huge. But the South didn't buy it. The South had persuaded itself. They wouldn't listen to Lincoln's argument that he was fine with them having slavery and that he would endorse the Fugitive Slave Act. They saw him as the Antichrist, literally. They believed that he was an abolitionist at heart, and as soon as he was president, he would abolish slavery. And if he abolished slavery, he would abolish Southern culture as they knew it overnight, right? And destroy them financially. So they were terrified. There was deep fear, and Lincoln didn't get that. He didn't get that at first. So that was a fundamental problem with his approach.
You wrote that
his approach then.
Yeah, you wrote that you were already working on the book when January 6th happened.
Right.
And I'm curious, you know, about your thoughts that day as you watched that unfold, as you
right.
were writing this book, and whether that in any way informed the finished product.
Well, okay. So I think what I want to do is go back a little bit then to sort of, you know, I mentioned that I had said never. Will I ever write a book about the Civil War? And you know, here I am. Let me explain why that was, because that's relevant to what you were just asking. I had been on a book tour with a book of mine called The Splendid and the Vile about Winston Churchill. And the pandemic strikes, right? I'm halfway through my book tour. And by the way, the tour until that point, it was like some suspense thriller. At each stop, something weirder was happening. You know, and finally I saw my first mask in the audience and I was like, ooh, something creepy is happening. And then boom, shuts down. I fly home on my wife's birthday, get home to our, you know, we had a place on Long Island and that became our pandemic redout. Get home there, and I have much more time on my hands than I had expected to have, you know, with the book tour and so forth being shut down. So I started looking, thought, okay, I'm going to try to be as productive as I can between bouts of sheer panic. I'm going to you know, look for potential ideas. About then, as today, unfortunately, there was a lot of political discord. There were people muttering about civil war, as there are now, and people muttering about secession, you know, Texas saying they're going to secede. And I said, go, fine. You know. I have to be fair. I have a daughter who lives and works in Austin, and she loves her life there, but of course, Austin is not, you know, Texas. So here I am. I've got time on my hands, and I started to think, okay, wait a minute. What secession? Okay, how did America actually get to the point of the Civil War? How did secession really happen? And so I started looking into various online troves of documents. Ordinarily, my MO is at this point. In the idea, story generation, idea generation, I would have gone to some physical archive and just dived in to see what was there with no previous planning, no plan, just dived in to see what was available. But of course, I couldn't because of the pandemic. And even if archives were open, which they weren't, I would have to fly there or take a train. I was not gonna do that. So I started looking more and more into these online archives. Happily, the Civil War, as we know, has been done often. So there are some very rich archives, you know, the complete works of Abraham Lincoln, the Lincoln Papers at the Library of Congress are all digitized, you know, some excellent things. But I came across this collection of documents called The War of the Rebellion, the Official Records of the Union and Confederate Armies. And so I ordered, was that a joke? I ordered a bound volume of Volume 1 because I hate actually doing digital research. It just, my mind goes dead when in front of a computer screen. And so this volume arrives. I disinfect it, you know, and then I start reading what's in it. And this thing was transformative for me. It kind of hundreds of documents, scrupulously curated in precise chronological order, letter response, telegram response, letter response, report response, and so forth, marking this march toward the start of the Civil War. Now, this kind of thing doesn't happen often for a writer. I mean, I've often had to fight to build a chronology that finding various pieces of material that go into the chronology. Here it was. This was the spine for what suddenly I thought was potentially a very compelling book. I mean, the TikTok, I'm not talking on the website, but the TikTok, as we journalists say, was already there, the step-by-step-by-step march toward war. I often think of this kind of thing as the spine to a book, or as I note in my author's note in this book, sort of the Christmas tree, and now I get to hang the ornaments on the tree. It's the ornaments that to me make a book work, and so I started looking for ornaments, and then came January 6, 2021. I mean, I was not committed to this book totally yet, but then came January 6, 2021. I'm watching this from my desk in New York. The entire day, you know, as those tourists, how horrible that they marched through the Capitol, as those tourists rip apart the Capitol, and I was appalled, but also kind of riveted by this, and I realized, you know, back in 1861, you know, people must have felt the same way, this caught up in this drama and the fear and the angst and so forth. And I realized then that this was not a story from the past. This is a story for today. And so I became much more committed to the story and finally just bit the bullet and did it.
Well, and I was struck by the fact that then as now, there was concern about whether the electoral count and the certification of the election would be disrupted by a militia.
In 1861, the two moments of gravest national concern were, would the electoral count come off? And would the inauguration come off?
Yeah. And even now, as you mentioned, there are people who are talking of civil war. There's a movie out, I understand, about that imagines a modern-day civil war.
Contemporary civil war,
in the United States. And so, as you were doing that research, watching January 6th, watching events unfold currently, what do you make of the moment in which we find ourselves?
The moment now?
Yeah.
Well... First of all, caveat, I made myself a resolution, New Year's resolution in January, never to talk politics with anyone over the age of 5. Having said that, I actually think the term demon of unrest is very apt for today. It does strike me, it is as if there is some demon loose in the land, stirring us all up, making us all dislike our fellow men. At root, what this book really is a story about the forces, personal characteristics, macro characteristics, politics, and so forth, the forces that coalesced to make Americans on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line come to the point where they could imagine the wholesale killing of each other. Now, I don't know that we're there yet. I certainly hope we're not, but I do know that you know, the FBI and Homeland Security are very interested in this sort of group of particularly fringe characters referred to as accelerationists. Have you heard this term? These are people who want to get things so bad so quickly that the nation falls apart and a new land arises from the rubble. It's not quite clear what that new land is supposed to be, but you know, so things are it's very relevant.
Yeah.
It's very relevant. But I don't like to wade into the politics.
The climax of the book, of course, is the bombardment of Fort Sumter in April of 1861.
Right.
Can you take us inside Fort Sumter and tell us what the conditions were like for Major Anderson and his men? What were they up against?
Sure. I will take you inside, but I'll not. There are spoiler alerts that I want to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, let me set this up a bit. Major Robert Anderson, I really like him. Major Robert Anderson was initially put in charge of He was put in charge of all the federal presence in Charleston Harbor. But his command center, his headquarters, was at a fort called Fort Moultrie on Sullivan's Island off Charleston. His actual headquarters was in a house outside Fort Moultrie. Yeah, you have to remember that Fort Moultrie and Fort Sumter were designed to defend Charleston and South Carolina against attack by foreign fleets, the French, the British, and the Spanish, who were still, in terms of strategy, the ones you had to worry about. So that's why Fort Moultrie existed, that's why Fort Sumter existed, and so forth. So Anderson is put in charge of these federal properties in Charleston Harbor. Things start to degrade. December 20, 1860, South Carolina declares itself a freestanding nation. It signs a secession ordinance. So suddenly, here's Anderson, surrounded by people who increasingly are intent on freeing themselves from the North and Northern tyranny. They see Fort Moultrie, they see Fort Sumter in particular, with its giant American flag, as it's like these things are like a thorn in the eye. You know, mm-hmm. they just can't stand it. Anderson senses this, and he realizes that his situation at Fort Moultrie, where he, again, that's his command post, is untenable because it was not built to defend against attack from behind by fellow Americans. That fort was so vulnerable. I mean, sand had blown to the point where there were dunes that led up to the rear walls, and on occasion a cow would wander into the fort, you know, so some Trojan cow maybe, I don't know, but so he realizes that this is, he cannot defend this fort. And he cooks up a plan. He is going to move his garrison, 75 regular Union guys, families, their families also. He's going to move them from Fort Moultrie under cover of darkness to Fort Sumter. He's going to do it on Christmas night, because Christmas being very much an important holiday then as now, but even more important then, there would be distraction and so forth, and maybe it would increase their chances of getting over to the fort. So he couldn't do it that night because the weather was too bad. He does it the next night, December 26th, and he pulls it off. He gets everybody over the Fort Sumter. People in Charleston are completely unaware that he has done this until in the morning they wake up, they look over at Fort Moultrie, and they see that Fort Moultrie is on fire. Fire is rising from this fort, smoke, because the guys that Anderson left behind had been left behind to destroy the cannon, burn the gun carriages, and so forth. Impossible to underestimate how furious this made Carolina authorities. Yeah. Immediately they seize Fort Moultrie, immediately they seize Castle Pinckney, Fort Johnson, the federal arsenal in Charleston, and demand that Anderson go back to Fort Moultrie. And he's like, no. I'm not going to go back there. And so that's the setup.
Yeah.
Now, you know, what that ultimately leads to, of course, is, you know, bad stuff. But I don't necessarily want to have the denouement of, there are interesting things that happen that you should read the book for.
Yes, and just the description of the way that he moved those troops from Fort Moultrie to Sumter is worth the book all by itself. I mean, because that was such an incredible feat
accomplished. But by the way, as I said, he had 75 men. Fort Sumter, a classic sea fortress, construction began in 1828. It was still not complete in 1860. It was designed to have 650 men. He had 75. And so that's the situation.
So before we get to our audience questions, there are many, many more things that we could talk about, but I would love for you to read a passage for us so we can hear it in your voice.
Sure.
It is a heavy story, as we all know, but there are some lighthearted moments contained in it, and I found one that I thought we could all enjoy. So
glad to.
And I guess we should set this up, that this is President Lincoln on his way.
Yeah, Lincoln kept quiet from after his election until his inauguration, because he was enough of a lawyer to know that he was not actually yet president. He was not president. Even though he was elected, even though eventually the electoral count does confirm that he was elected, but it's the inauguration that is the thing. And he stays quiet throughout this period. But comes time for him to go to Washington to be inaugurated. He's living in Springfield, Illinois. he sets out on this marvelous train journey, 13-day train journey, to literally let people in America see him, to know the people who voted for him. And by the way, 10 southern states did not put him on the ballot, you know, because, you know, that's what you did when you didn't want to have an abolitionist become president. So he does this wonderfully charismatic train journey from Springfield to Washington, D.C., and this is the passage that you want here. On that afternoon, February 11, Lincoln's special, that's his train, stopped at Thorntown, Indiana. You know, he's making his way through all these small towns, stopping, smiling, speaking. In most places, he does not speak. He just says, sometimes he mocks himself. He says, I just wanted you to appreciate how beautiful I am. And then he moves on. So anyway, on that afternoon of February 11, Lincoln's special stopped at Thorntown, Indiana, to once again take on fuel. As had occurred at every prior stop, a crowd gathered and demanded a speech. Lincoln parried this by offering to tell one of the folksy stories of which he seemed to have an inexhaustible supply. He cautioned, however, that he probably shouldn't be telling stories, given that he was on his way to assume the highest office in the land, but he would tell it, quote, if you promise not to let it out. He began, a man running for a county office had a favorite horse that was sure-footed but slow. The man knew he was likely to win the nomination for the office. On the day of the convention, he set out on his horse for the county seat, but the animal insisted on nibbling every comely bush along the way, despite the would-be candidate's use of a whip and spurs to prod it along. Lincoln was midway through a sentence when the train began to move. Lincoln laughed, the crowd laughed, someone shouted, he need not worry about this particular story getting out. Lincoln waved, the train gained speed. At the next stop, Lebanon, Indiana, 10 miles farther on, Lincoln stepped out onto the end platform of his car just as a group of people came running up along the tracks. These were local citizens, but a joke circulated that they were actually residents of Thorntown, the previous stop, who had run all the way and were, quote, panting outside to hear the conclusion of the story, end quote. Lincoln found this hilarious and retold the story, this time to completion, how the horse moved so slowly that the candidate arrived at the county seat after the convention had ended. If he gave a speech at every stop, Lincoln said, the same would happen to him. He would not reach Washington until the inauguration was over. Again he laughed. He always did like his own jokes. And again his audience laughed too. I bid you an affectionate farewell, he said. I cannot miss the inauguration. So.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, on that bright note, let's take your questions, comments for Eric Larson. Hands raised, I see. Okay.
And by the way, you could ask me about any book, anything you want, except for one thing, and I won't tell you what that is.
Thank you so much for the book and the scholarship that's gone into it.
Sure.
It seems to me that one of the factors that contributed to the country falling into the abyss was the relatively disarmed state of the Union in 1861. And that is to say, the federal government really lacked any consequential force in being that could provide a deterrence against secession. And so, firstly, do you agree with that? And is there any, do you think that the fact that we have a greatly expanded federal government now with a, does that provide some insulation about against repeating the tragedy? Thank you.
So you're going to have to repeat the second question. You're going to have to repeat the first again. So what was the gist of the question? There's the theory that that the North, that America did not have a sufficient military to do anything about secession, right? That's the theory.
Yes.
I don't actually buy that. I think the bigger problem. Yeah, when secession was declared in December 20, 1860, that was the time to make a move on the part of the federal government. The government did nothing. Why? Because we had the second worst president in American history in the job. Are you all five? We had James Buchanan as the president, an inept, passive president, which is so strange because his prior political career would have suggested that he would be a fantastic president. He had a stellar political career prior to becoming president. And then it's like his brain shut down. You know, he was very passive. All he wanted to do, this conflict was rising on his during his tenure. All he wanted to do was get out before war began and get back to his mansion just outside Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and retire peacefully, right? Wheatlands. So there was this vacuum, this leadership vacuum. I mean, Anderson was the direct, let's say, victim of this passivity. He got no orders. The one thing he heard was when an inspector, this name will be familiar to some of you who are Civil War buffs, Don Carlos Buell, was actually dispatched by the War Department to come to talk to Anderson, deliver really the only orders that he got during this whole process. And he tells Anderson that he is authorized to hold the fort, Fort Moultrie, to hold federal properties in Charleston to the last extremity. That's where we are. But there was otherwise this complete vacuum. Anderson got no communications, got no orders. The time to have moved would have been then when there were, you know, there was Fort Sumter, which Anderson at this point, you know, occupied. After he made his move, he occupies Fort Sumter. It is a very defensible position. The South has not yet responded to the fact that he's there, not militarily. But there's no communication from Washington, so there's very passive. You know, I mean, I'll speak in terms of the Union as we had warships. You know, we had an army, a small army. I mean, we had like 16,000 regular soldiers, regular army. But, you know, you don't necessarily need a military force. You need to at least stand up and say, stop it. What are you doing? You can't secede, you know. Like Andrew Jackson in the previous nullification crisis in South Carolina, when South Carolina decided we were just going to nullify federal law. And Jackson said, no, you're not. And they backed down. And so that, you know, but there was nobody to make South Carolina back down. Now, today, I mean, I can't even engage in speculation about potential for civil war or whether the fact that we're armed to the teeth both federally and locally, whether that's gonna do or not do. So can't really help you on that one.
How would the spirit of unrest in the South prior to the Civil War compare to the feeling in Germany in 1933, like you covered in Garden of Beasts?
Well, you know, 1933-34 in Germany, you know, that there was this desire to somehow recoup Germany's lost hegemony in the world. You know, it was a very different phenomenon, honestly. Yeah, I just think it was a very different phenomenon. But I'll be sleeping tonight thinking about it all night long.
I just want to say, first off, Devil in the White City changed my life, and I collect a massive amount of Chicago World's Fair memorabilia now because of it. So my girlfriend would not thank you, but I want to say thank you. My question
Give her my apologies, okay.
I'll pass it on to her. She's not here tonight. I offered. Don't awe, it's fine. So my question is, in a larger sense, do you have either a time period or an event or a person that is kind of like your white whale, like something that you wish, that you find truly fascinating, that you want to write about, but maybe you can't find enough material or you can't find a way to present it in a large enough format for a modern audience?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Is there one white whale? It's not so much that there's one white whale. There are a number of white whales. You know, I mean, for example, I am fascinated by Magellan, right? But I can't write about him. There is not enough of the rich, firsthand detail to make the narrative as rich as it could possibly be, so that you can metaphorically sink into that particular narrative. Pompeii, you know, but they're the same issue there. You know, I mean, I would need, you know, diaries and letters and everything, and there are some things, but not enough for me. But those would be a couple of things.
I'm also a big fan. I had a question about language.
Okay.
So I'm in education, and so right now there's a big push to talk about, as you did for on the stage, enslaved people versus
yes.
slaves. And I noticed you said planters as opposed to enslaved people, or masters as opposed to enslavers.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, and I imagine it's something you have to think about a lot as an author, both in terms of what you write in the book and then how you talk about the characters.
Right.
And I just wanted to kind of hear your thoughts, particularly around an issue that is so contested in kind of the language that is used.
Yeah, it's, you know, it is a very thorny issue, you know, and I get it. And one should say enslaved blacks versus slaves, you know, it gives much more of an element of humanity and indicates what direction the enslavement was coming from, you know. I totally get that. As a writer, it imposes some very difficult issues. For example, let's say you have a paragraph in which, if you were writing this in 1960, you would have used the word slave 8 times. Okay. Now, the way I approached it was, okay, we say enslaved black, maybe say it again, then say slave in that paragraph, just to indicate. We understand, we get it, right? But then there are the demands of, you know, you don't want to write something that is risible, you know, to readers. Where if you say enslaved, so you just have to follow your instincts and really feel your way. It's difficult. As far as masters, you know, I avoided the word masters as much as I could. Maybe you noticed that. I was fine with planters and so forth, but it's a thicket, you know. It's a real thicket. Did you by any chance read a review in the New York Times of a novel of a quite famous novelist had done a book about the antebellum period involving slavery and so forth, and went too far in the other direction, and was taken to task for too much, you know, bending over backwards not to say, you know, slave and so forth. So. I don't know. I just tried to follow my instincts, and, you know, come hell or high water. How do you think I did?
I thought I was trying to think about, like, balancing historical authenticity. So
yeah.
I think a lot of the, like, I've read previous books, and you've talked about in author notes how in places where you're oftentimes quoting, even if it's not in quotes. And so I was thinking about kind of using language that to us as modern readers reads kind of very jarring and marginalized. Like, I would, like,
right.
And so I was just really interested to hear your
perspective. I understand. So yeah, I mean, ordinarily my attitude is, you know, I really try to stick to point of view, like screenwriters say, POV, and really write from the perspective of the moment. But, you know, there are, if you were to do that in this era, I mean, there are certain words that you cannot use, you know, the N-word, you know, for case in point. But here's a couple of interesting things. First of all, I found this fascinating. You know, all the planters' diaries and so forth that I read, they really rarely use the word slaves. They use the word hands, H-A-N-D-S, a lot. They use the word Negroes a lot. But the word slaves was often missing from diaries, which I found fascinating, you know. So anyway, I'm not really helping, but read the book, let me know. So far nobody has come after me.
Hi. I have read all of your books since I was first introduced to them almost 20 years ago, and I just fell in love with your writing style. And I think one of the, because I love history and I love how you mesh the topics, and you did talk about this a little bit earlier about why you were not interested in writing about the Civil War. But I just find the topics and how you meld them together with what's going on in history and what's going on in a particular area very fascinating. So I'm just curious, how do you pick your topics? How do you choose, you know, Isaac Storms about what happened in Galveston and the hurricane and the start of meteorology?
Right.
How do you hone in on that?
I wish I had a 3D printer that would print out my ideas. You know, I could just type something in and get some ideas back. It's all case by case. Each story, each book has a different origin story. You know, I mean, you mentioned that I had said that I never would write a book about the Civil War. Main reason being that the barriers to entry, as business folk would like to say, is so high. You have to read so much stuff just to be able to start recognizing, okay, maybe I can say something new, right? But when you have a pandemic and you got time on your hands, the story met the moment. I'll give you a case in point. Probably the most bizarre origin story of these of my many books was a book called Thunderstruck. Did you read Thunderstruck? Okay, Thunderstruck about, thank you.
Okay.
Thunderstruck is about, you know, about Marconi, the inventor of wireless, and England's second most famous murderer, Hawley Harvey Crippen, the first, of course, being Jack the Ripper. The way that book came about was so bizarre. I was living in Seattle at the time. I was driving over my favorite bridge and my favorite location in Seattle, the Montlake Cut. Some of you may know it. And driving over this drawbridge, and a guy cuts me off in his car because he's on his cell phone, right? He's talking on his cell phone. And I was furious. And I'm driving across the bridge, I'm seething, and I see a cell phone tower. And suddenly I thought, hey, I wonder if there's a book in wireless, you know? Maybe there's some element. So I get home right away, I fire up my computer, and of course I Google wireless. And I go right to the modern incarnation of the Marconi Company, which has a timeline. And I'm looking through this timeline, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then I come across Hawley Harvey Crippen, the murderer. I'm like, what the hell? What's he doing in a corporate timeline about wireless? But then something else really freaky happened. I flashed back to when I was a kid, and my mother told me the story of Crippen in the kitchen of our home in Freeport, Long Island. It must have been the time. It must have been when one of the ship captains had died. That's why it was in the news. I don't know. But suddenly this came back to me. It's like, that's right. There was this story of this murderer. And I looked into it, and I found this weird nexus between their careers. And that's what made me begin at least to start looking into it. Now, I held off. I was really reluctant for a while because I had just had Devil in the White City, which is two narratives don't really touch, you know, and footnote, on the eve of publication of that book, I was convinced my career was over. No, a gospel truth, I asked my wife, because it had these two narratives and they never touched. So here I was diving in again, and this would be another dual narrative. Did I want to be, you know, tarred with that reputation as always doing dual narratives? But then I thought, well, it's a good story, so I'll just tell it. But anyway, that's the origin story. Everyone is different. Everyone is different.
Given, I haven't read the book, obviously. Given the economic disparity at the time between the North and South, did the South and the people who were attempting to secede ever examine the possibility that they could succeed against this juggernaut of the North? I mean, they didn't own a locomotive that wasn't made in the North.
They were extraordinarily arrogant in that respect. And I'll give you, this is another reason why I have this planter, Senator James Henry Hammond, why he's an important character. Because a speech of his in 1858 embodies the arrogance of the South. This is the famous Cotton is King speech. It's also famous for something called, it's also referred to as the Mud Sills speech. In this speech before the Senate, he first of all openly declares that enslaved blacks were the mud sills of society. Somebody had to do the menial work, and happily we have a race at hand that is suited to the job. And mudsills being, by the way, the part of a structure between the earth and the frame of the building. So there's that element of that speech. But more importantly, he coined the phrase, cotton is king. And by that, his thesis was that the South produced the world's cotton. If the South decided to stop producing, if there was a conflict that led to the end of the production of cotton, the world would be brought to its knees. That was his philosophy. Delusional philosophy, as it happened, But this was something that was very heavily believed in the South. So there was no examination of the fact that the North was rapidly ramping up in terms of industrial power and so forth. I found a very interesting statistic in the census records of 1860, that in the North there was something like 3,060 people identified themselves as railroad workers. In South Carolina, there were like 90, and so it's overwhelming disparity. And the Southern planters were very happy with their world, and they imagined themselves to be very powerful. So that's a big part of it.
In researching your book, what surprised you the most?
Boy, what surprised me the most? You know what surprised me the most? When I was delving into South Carolina culture, the culture of the planter aristocracy, or what one writer referred to as the slaveocracy, I really became caught up in this idea, reading about the fact that these planters really saw themselves as sort of a race apart. They referred to themselves literally as the chivalry. And they were completely caught up in the romantic novels of Sir Walter Scott, the poetry of Tennyson, and so forth. I mean, they bought this stuff to the point where they held rings tournaments where these planters, these chivalrous planters, men of honor, would dress up as their favorite knight, and for these ring tournaments they would get on the horse and ride down this course with a lance. They weren't actually jousting because you could kill somebody. Ride down the course with a lance, the goal being to pierce get the tip of the lance through a hanging ring, a series of hanging rings. And then if it was a heads and rings tournament, to at the end whip out your saber and slash away at an inanimate figure at the end. So, but just the idea that these people were sort of play-acting chivalry from Sir Arthur's court was to me a real eye-opener. It's like the land that time forgot was a big part of the story, They loved this life of, planters, thanks to the labor of their enslaved black populations, were able to lead this life of, and I'm talking about a fairly small subset, by the way, of people who owned slaves and who were in the planting business. But these were the guys who had the political power. They owned hundreds of slaves and so forth. So I mean, these people were able to lead this life of indolence and build these beautiful plantations and so forth because of the labor of their enslaved blacks. And that was, to me, I knew about it, of course, but I wasn't aware of how that really played in terms of political power and the culture of the South.
Thank you. To be a bit iconoclastic, I have a question for you. Was there any thought in the North that if the South wanted to leave, let it go? The North was much more prosperous, was much stronger, if anything, and that the South was an albatross.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, to be an iconoclast, is wasn't this country founded on the principle of self-determination? And the South was stating that it wanted to do what the colonies had done just 60 or 70 years before.
Right, right. Yeah, so you're not being that iconoclastic. I mean, there are scholars who have, what you're touching on is the ineffable question, really, at root. Was the Civil War avoidable? Could we have just let them go, right? And in fact, Horace Greeley at one point said famously during this period after secession, and he said, if they want to, let them go. And the South really took heart to this. But then Horace Greeley changed his opinion rather radically. He said, let them go if Congress approves, if we do this, this, and this. But you raise a very interesting question that I have mulled time and time again. It was like, okay, why not let them go? What's the value of union? What was it that for Lincoln was just completely unacceptable about South Carolina deciding it wanted to secede from the Union? Why bother maintaining the Union at all? And I don't have an answer. So, you know, I don't engage in speculative history, so, I mean, sorry to leave you on a, such an unsatisfactory note.
Well, thank you all so much for being with us tonight.
And thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.